Well, that's me, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. My guest this evening has been Neil Story. We're going to open up the phone lines. If you have questions for our guest regarding Jack the Ripper, Dracula, any of the things we've covered this evening, feel free to give us a call and be a part of the show. Before we do to that, let's jump back in real quickly with Neil. I know you know a lot of different ghost stories and paranormal stories, as Neil is an award-winning historian and lecturer who has published over 30 books, including East End Murders. Can you tell us one of your favorite ghost stories before we go to the next break?
Yes, one of my favorite ghost stories comes from North Norfolk, my home county, and it involves the fishing community. Now, there's two little towns out this way. One is called Cromer, and the other is called Sheringham, that nestle on the North Norfolk coast. Now, the trouble is, Cromer always did rather well because it always had a holiday industry. And before Sheringham developed theirs, they didn't. And it meant that the Cromer boys, if the weather was bad, they didn't have to go to sea. Whereas the Sheringham boys, well, if they didn't go to sea and do their fishing, well, there'd be nothing on the table for their family to eat of a night time. So there was a bit of animosity between the two. Cromer men were always known as crabs, and Sheringham men were always known as shannocks, which is based on a Norfolk word from shanny, meaning a bit mad, because they were mad to go to sea in those high winds and bad weather. Now, between those two towns, there's a village called Runton, and they've got a fisherman's gap, and that's the kind of divide line. And in the 19th century, if there was a wreck, 18th and 19th centuries, if there was wreck off the coast, ship goes down, the wreckage comes up on the Cromer side of that gap, it would belong to the Cromer men. They could get their bounty off there, and it would be up to them to bury the bodies of any of the seamen that may get washed up. If it fell on the Sheringham side, they get the bounty, but they also have to bury the bodies. It was seen as the good thing to do, that wherever fishermen may be, all around Great Britain, you know, if a body's washed up, you would make sure it gets a decent burial. And it would be paid for sometimes with a golden earring. Fishermen used to wear those. That would be enough for a decent burial. Or the wreckage. And that would pay, and more sometimes. But one day, so the story goes, a ship goes down immediately in front of that gap. And all that's really washed up is a little bit of wreckage and these bodies. And the Cromer and the Sheringham men are out digging bait, and they meet at the gap. And Cromer says to the Sheringham, "Oh, that's going to cost you to bury all that lot. There's nothing to bury them. You better do it and make haste of it." The Sheringham men say to the Cromer boys, "Hang you on. There's more on your side. There's more bodies spread up your way. You must bury them." Neither side could agree, and it almost resorted to violence. And one bites back, says, "Well, why don't we just get a great big hole, dig it on the beach, dig it deep, all of us. We'll put the bodies in there and just cover it over." And that supposedly is what they did. And those sailors were given no Christian burial. Now, that meant that their spirits couldn't rest. It wasn't long before both sides, they were experiencing something which became known as the Yow-Yows. Now, the Yow-Yows, the story goes, and I've met a few fishermen that say they've heard it, you could be out in your fishing boat, small boat, fishing for crabs with crab pots. And you'll hear a voice calling for help. And you'll look around, you can't see it, but you'll row over to where the voice is coming from and find that there's no one there. Oh, maybe it's the wind in your ears playing tricks with you. So you'll row back to where your crab pots are. When you get back there, the voice comes from underneath your boat. "Help me, help me." Well, that will mean one of two things. Number one, you've just run over the bloke you're trying to rescue. Or number two, and that's the way the fishermen tell the tale, I'll tell you. Or number two, it's a yow-yow. And that's most likely. He's there and he's a-calling for you. And unless you row to shore as fast as you come, there is a squall on its way, and it will claim you and take you down to Davy Jones's locker. And you too will never be able to rest. And you will become the voice of a yow-yow.
Neil Story, our guest. We will continue with more of his ghost stories, and we'll begin taking your calls if you have questions regarding Jack the Ripper and Dracula, Bram Stoker, any of that. Feel free to give us a call and be a part of the show. We'll continue with more of the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Evening, early morning here with Neil Story, our guest. We have a link up for Neil's book and for his information and website. You can find that at coasttocoastam.com. He will continue to regale us with spooky tales throughout the evening. We'll also work in your phone calls. Right now, let's go east of the Rockies. Jason in Florida, welcome to the show. Jason, Florida, have we got you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, great. Welcome to the show, Jason. What was what did you want to add to the show this evening?
Oh, I'm surprised I'm first. It's a great show. Great
Thank
job,
you.
Neil. I've been fascinated.
Thank you.
I don't know what all I have time to squeeze in. I was just saying how, from what I remember, and I've seen the movie, and I originally saw it in theaters, the 92 movie with Gary Oldman, as I remember, my take on it was, he basically was Vlad the Emperor, and they portrayed it as, with Gary Oldman, that he kind of basically made a pact with the devil there, more or less, and that's how he came to be what he was. And then I was kind of wondering, I didn't know if he had any insight possibly into the legend or origin of Ichabod Crane, Sleepy Hollow, or the Headless Horseman, possibly. And then my comment basically was I just found it ironic and a double standard even going way back then with the homosexuality aspect of, he said, possibly, and his take on it, likely, of the two men, where as with Dracula's Guest, the Bram Stoker prequel novel, and he basically said this was so similar to, I believe he said the woman's name was Catherine something, and her book was something Glass Dark something, which was basically a lesbian novel. So I found that ironic and double standard, even going way back then, where, you know, that was okay and accepted, so to speak.
I agree with you. It is the double standard. If we go back to the first point, where does Bram get his literature from? Well, his entire, what was left of his library was sold by Sotheby's after his death, and as an appendix in my book, Dracula's Secrets, I've actually listed the original auction lots. Now, sadly, there is not an awful lot of American literature in there, but it doesn't mean that, and Bram had toured America, he was friendly with and communicated regularly with Walt Whitman. He was also a friend of Wilkie Collins, as was Hall Caine. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if he had heard and was aware of the Sleepy Hollow tale, and particularly the way it is set in this rural community, a community of old beliefs, meeting a new and developing world. So, yes, I think there is a very good chance. We can't prove it. It's not clearly connected in any of the notes, but there is that chance. Coming on to what was entitled, the film was entitled Bram Stoker's Dracula. Now, although it is a cracking film, let's face it, it's a goodie, but Bram Stoker's Dracula, it ain't. And the whole premise of Dracula being Vlad Tepes simply doesn't exist in those notes. And there's and Bram was very, very good with his notes. And I think if he had known of that story of impalement, of a pact with the devil, with the whole genre of Vlad Tepes, it would have seduced him. He would have absolutely loved it. And it would be overtly recorded in his notes, probably copiously. It simply doesn't appear there. So although the film, yes, it's well worth seeing, I love it for what it is, but it is a metamorphosis of the story of Bram Stoker's Dracula, not a loving portrayal of it in film.
There's never really been a portrayal in film that's very religious to the original context of the book, is there?
No, there really isn't. It was when Christopher Lee played Dracula, and I think his performance is absolutely outstanding, and in many ways, to me, it's unparalleled. But because of the height of the man, I met Christopher Lee once, and the man's persona, his charisma, it was amazing. Absolutely. He didn't have to say a word. It was the look of the man. His background was European aristocracy. The Caldini family, you know, on his mother's side. A remarkable man. Enormously well-read. It was perfect casting. But Lee felt that he never was able to explore Dracula in the scripts and the portrayals that he had to do that he did within the Hammer films. But there is a documentary that was produced in the 1970s before we have the greater knowledge that we do of the lack of connection with Vlad Tepes, where Lee does appear as part of the documentary as Vlad Tepes. He looks amazing. And he also reconstructs some of the scenes exactly as they appeared in Bram Stoker's book, with Count Dracula appearing with a large, a heavy moustache and white hair swept back, just as he was described in Bram's original book. There's only one illustration, you know, of Dracula that Bram ever saw and clearly approved of, and that was on the cheap paperback edition, and it shows Dracula climbing down a wall with bat wings and rather odd-looking webbed feet. But the face on it is this swept back white hair and large moustached Dracula. So it's, and you know, there are, you can see parallels with Vlad Tepes. It's very seductive. But sadly, the notes simply do not mention him at all. But it's lovely to see Christopher Lee in that documentary exploring it, and it shows what a well-read and eloquent man and charismatic man Christopher Lee was. And I'd urge you to try and track that documentary film down. And it actually shows Lee over in Romania and Transylvania exploring some of the sites that are described in Bram Stoker's book. So that's fantastic.
Thank you for calling in, Jason. You know, one of my favorite movies that came out was Dracula 2000. And when it came out, it's not an overly great movie, but I thought it was one of the most ingenious backstories for Dracula ever given. That, spoiler alert coming, that they turned him into Judas Iscariot. And that the reason he had an aversion to silver was because he had betrayed Christ for the 13 pieces of silver. And because he hung himself at dusk, that's why he would never see another sunrise. That was part of his punishment. I just thought it was a fascinating take on the character and story. And I've enjoyed all of the different iterations of people trying to bring a new twist to it. Has there been one of the movies that's really stood out to you as kind of a superior story? And even though it's not following Bram Stoker's true intention of the story?
For me, I like the Gary Oldman. I think that was very good. In all of the Dracula films, it's so frustrating that there are elements that I think, oh God, that's so, particularly those set in 19th century Britain, I think, oh God, it's so close, if only they'd followed this theme or that theme. It's very frustrating. Some of the TV dramatizations have done very well. There was one in the 1970s, which had Frank Finlay playing Van Helsing. And I think that's probably the closest that we've got to date. But that's a TV drama produced by the BBC.
All right, let's grab another quick call before break. Wildcard line to John in Long Beach, California. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, thank you. Just real quick, there was a Laker player, Los Angeles Laker player named Vlade Divac, and I used to cover the team. And we were in prayer, and he was a chain smoker, so somebody dubbed him Vlad the Inhaler. Just a little joke. But anyway, I studied the Jack the Ripper thing over the years, and I was fascinated with it as a child. And they seem to have two main suspects. One, if I am not mistaken, was a guy they thought was a surgeon, that allegedly was a surgeon whose son had contracted the venereal disease from one of the hookers or the prostitutes in Whitechapel, and this guy went back to try to find her, and he eventually found her, when that was the one that was the most cut up at the end. Ed O's, was it, or something like that? That's one theory. And the other theory
was the last one that was horrifically mutilated in her own room.
One maybe that a guy that also was a butcher in Cleveland had also been in England, that Elliot Ness could never catch. But anyway, the first one sounds the most likely. What's your thoughts on it?
Well, for my money, and from my view, I don't think it was a butcher. I really don't, because of the lack of knowledge of how a human body goes together. And also, I don't feel it was a butcher because of the speed that he was working in the dark to remove the organs that we know were taken away. And based on the comments of the surgeons at the time at the inquest, these are the surgeons that have had the chance to have to see the bodies for themselves. The bodies, this is not wild cutting. Although the mutilations are absolutely horrific, they are delivered with quite some considerable precision and control, something that you would associate far more with a surgeon than somebody that has attacked a human and gone absolutely berserk. So it's knowledge and it's skill that's shown in those killings. So a butcher, I don't think so, but there are many permeations of on the theme of it being a surgeon and driven to commit the murder for a variety of reasons, that they detest prostitutes, that they've had a member of their family that has been infected with a sexual disease. Indeed, Francis Tumblety developed his hatred, so the story goes, because that his wife was a closet prostitute and gave him such a sexual transmitted disease that no longer made him a man. So there's a lot of good reasons to think, yeah, it could well have been a surgeon.
We need to come up against another break here, and we'll continue taking your calls. When we come back, Neil Story will share another of his favorite ghost stories, and we'll continue with your calls. This is the best in overnight talk radio. Filling in this evening, I'm Dave Schrader, and you're tuned in to Coast AM. Neil Story, our guest, as we continue talking about the Dracula secrets, Jack the Ripper, and the darkest sources of Bram Stoker. A very special thank you to Nathan back at home office for pulling all the great music that we've played this evening in honor of the life and musical legacy that is Prince, the many songs that he made famous on his own and the many songs that he was involved in behind the scenes that were famous for other singers. It's been a pleasure to bring that to you tonight on the night that they laid him to rest finally. And although he's gone, he's never gone in our hearts for good. Prince will live on in eternity because of the magical music and entertainment that he created. Tonight, our guest, Neil Story, has joined us. We've been talking about Jack the Ripper and ties to the Dracula storyline and Bram Stoker. A fascinating history and a different look at both of these stories that we've been so familiar with in the past. Neil is also a historian and knows quite a few ghost stories. Could you give us another quick little ghost story before the break here, Neil?
One of my favorite little tales relates to Blickling Hall, a magnificent Jacobean country house. And the house that dates before that goes way, way back. And it was, at one time, the childhood home of Queen Anne Boleyn, the second wife of Henry VIII of England. So this is Henry VIII, famous for having six wives. She was his second wife. And tragically, she couldn't
give him the son that he desperately craved. She presented him with a daughter, a most magnificent girl that grew up to become Queen Elizabeth I. The king fell out of love with Anne Boleyn because she failed to present him with a son. She produced a stillborn child, and as he tired of her, he wangled ways to get rid of her. And on trumped-up charges of treason, Anne Boleyn was put to death on Tower Green on the 19th of May, 1536. It's said, you know, that in the cell before she faced that horrible death, that she reflected quite a bit on her happy early life at Blickling Hall. She was decapitated on the green, not by axe, but kneeling upright, and a sword used parallel with the ground, and it was just swept across and removed her head with one clean sweep. Her body was then buried with little ceremony in a humble arrow chest in the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula within the walls of the tower. And there she, dare I say, rested. Well, her ghost is said to haunt more places in Britain than just about any other famous figure. And of course she haunts Blickling Hall. It's probably the most dramatic of all her appearances, for even though the old hall is gone, the driveway is still there. It is said on midnight, on the 19th of May every year since, a phantom carriage drawn by headless horses, driven on by a headless horseman, drives up the road at breakneck speed, and in the back of the carriage is Queen Anne Boleyn's body, sat upright, her neck a raw stump, and her head rattling around on her lap. All those that see this carriage must turn away. Turn your face to the walls, my darling, for if you hear the halloo of the coachman, then he will know, and he will gather you up, throw you into the back of the carriage, and carry you down to hell.
Neil Story, our guest this evening. We'll be back. We've got your calls, more ghost stories, and more questions as we talk about the connections of Jack the Ripper and Bram Stoker's Dracula here on Coast to Coast AM. Your phone calls, and we have some emails coming in. If you have a question for our guest and can't get through on the lines, you can email me at dave@darknessradio.com. dave@darknessradio.com. And if you're up for the adventure of a lifetime and you'd like to join me in Germany and Prague with about 20 of our other listeners, we're going to be going this June 20th through the 27th on a full-on paranormal investigation and tour, a haunted and historical tour of Germany and Prague. We are going to see some of the most fascinating locations. If you're interested and you'd like more information, shoot me an email at dave@darknessradio.com. Again, dave@darknessradio.com. And again, if you've missed any part of tonight's show, shame on you. You need to catch up because this was a great episode. Neil Story, our guest this evening, has been giving us the insights and backgrounds on two of the most fascinating characters in history, Dracula and Jack the Ripper, and the unlikely ties that brought them together. So if you'd like to hear the entire episode in its entirety, go to coasttocoastam.com, coasttocoastam.com. Get yourself a one-year subscription and become a Coast Insider. It breaks down to just 15 cents a day. You'll get 5 years of past archives. You'll get live chats with George Norrie, some of the other hosts, and the amazing guests from Coast to Coast AM. You'll also see all the great news stories and other content that we have on the site exclusive for insiders. Go become an insider today, and you'll find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. While you're there, check out George Norrie's TV show. A lot of people don't know that he has a TV show, but it's true, Beyond Belief. And you can find more information at beyondbelief.com. So if you enjoy the things you hear on Coast to Coast, wait till you see what George has to share with you on the TV series, beyondbelief.com. Speaking of Beyond Belief, I mean, these are amazing stories we've been hearing tonight. I do have a couple of questions from email form, if you don't mind me throwing them your way. The first one comes from Jim in California. Neil, he says, great and interesting topic tonight. And I have a question for you, Neil. Was Jack the Ripper in any way possibly related to Spring-Heeled Jack? And the murders were possibly escalations of his documented attacks. And maybe you could give us a brief explanation of who Spring-Heeled Jack was and what the ties could be on this.
Now, Spring-Heeled Jack predates Jack the Ripper. And this takes us to about 20 years before. Spring-Heeled Jack appeared in London, and he is a character. At that time, there was a book that came out called Spring-Heeled Jack. Did he really exist or not? Is he based on the characters in a book? Is he a copycat? Or is he the result of a mass panic where impressionable people believe that they see this character? The actual attacks ascribed to him normally involve a young lady crossing a parkland or not desperately populated area, an open area of heath in London. In those days, there were far bigger and wide open spaces around the capital in those days. And he would leap out from the bushes. The girls that would be in their corsets, tightly laced, would normally pass out, and then they would be discovered later. They hadn't been outraged, and that was the old phrase for rape, but they would normally be left in an embarrassing and revealed way, so that the skirts would be thrown up. In those days, ladies did not wear knickers. They wore a type of underdraw that was a divided underdraw, which meant that if your legs were open, it would show the private parts of the body. And so these ladies would be left revealed, so to speak. Another girl said bodices ripped. And another account that escalates in the Spring-Heeled Jack stories is that a servant goes to a door one night. There's this strange figure dressed in a skin-tight leather suit, wearing a strange mask, and she answers the door, and he belches blue flames at her. And then he suddenly pings off, and she is left in a shocked state. Now, from that time onwards, there have been occasional appearances of Spring-Heeled Jacks of varying description, but the thing that's common to all of them, it seems to be this sort of skin-tight suit. Sometimes he's wearing a helmet with horns on it, and he appears, he frightens people, he startles people. It's been shot at. It's never been hit. It appears to both men and women, and ping, off he goes, sometimes leaping, they say, as high as terraced house rooftops. Whether he really exists or not, we just don't know. When you come and you study mass panics, people can see things that are absolutely impossible, and people get caught up in it. So whether he ever really existed or not, we don't know. What we do know is that the Whitechapel murderer is real. Those murders really did take place. The chances are it was by the hand of one man operating in the autumn of 1888. The name Jack the Ripper comes from a letter that was sent to the Central News Agency. Now, the point is, the letter purports to come from Jack, but it is thought to have been written by a Fleet Street reporter. And the reporter, in a stroke of genius, really, taps in to a psyche, a Victorian psyche that knows the name Jack as a sort of everyman character. So you will know of Spring-Heeled Jack, you'll know of Jolly Jack Tar, you'll know of Jack and Napes, phrases like everyman Jack of them, jack-o'-lanterns that were another ghost manifestation. So Jack is known to the Victorian public only too well, often in quite a dark light rather than a positive light. Jack the Ripper, what a seductive title. it absolutely captured the imagination of the British public. So, to be honest, in my own view, and I'm sure it is shared by many others, the connection with Spring-Heeled Jack, although it is seductive, is only really in the name Jack being involved there, and that these both Jack the Ripper and Spring-Heeled Jack develop this sort of mythical beast attachment, this superhuman, supernatural character at the time.
Let's go to Jeff in Culver City on the Wild Card One line. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Dave and Mr. Neil Story?
Doing well.
Congratulations on becoming a grandfather, Mr. Schrader.
Thank you.
Yes, I've been intrigued with Jack the Ripper man for years, and I wondered why he hated these women and killed them in such a horrible and disgusting manner. As a child, I grew up around some very bad people, man, who engaged in all types of immorality, horror, and violence. You know, many of my own family members, you know, were involved in that mess, and myself included. But after reading about, you know, Jack the Ripper and understanding his possible motives, it made me, you know, think about where the origins of, you know, or the sources of his anger emanated from. And I believe that it had something to do with his mother or a grandmother or some type of mother figure. Of course, this is a story. If Jack the Ripper had a deep and profound hatred toward his mother or a mother figure, do you believe that this triggered the horrific murderous acts? And do you believe that his spirit lived on in other serial killers like Ted Bundy, the Hillside Stranglers, and others who hated women and who killed them, you know, whether they're prostitutes or not? And I'll take care of that.
Well, that's a fascinating take on it. And I, sadly, because Jack the Ripper was never caught and we've never positively identified who it was, we can't say for certain what the drives for him to commit these murders were. It's been very interesting to hear the study of people like Robert Ressler and John Douglas in America, but also to hear the work of criminal psychologists in Great Britain, many of which I've spoken to personally over the years. And there are numerous factors that can drive somebody to commit horrific crimes against other human beings. What we can say is that the prostitutes then and now are one of the most vulnerable classes of women anywhere. So he's attacking a very vulnerable people. Very vulnerable indeed. So what motivated him? Yes, there's certainly a sexualist psychopathy within that, in that something must have generated it, and it could have been through constant exposure to violence at a young age, rather like the Henry Lee Lucas case that you'll be familiar with in America. Or perhaps it was in greater maturity, being a bit of a lost character, being betrayed, perhaps an interfamilial relationship that was both violent and threatening, and perhaps left him with a sexual disease or a psychopathy, which has manifested into a bitter hatred of women. For example, with Francis Tumblety, he was known to even have a collection of women's uterus preserved in jars that he would keep in a cupboard, and after evening meals with gentlemen friends, he would open the cupboard and show these uterus and explain why he found women quite so disgusting. But there are many, many different permeations that this could be. And
right.
If you look at the characters like Ted Bundy, of course, you know, it was a thrill kill situation.
And a controlling factor, kind of getting that control back. from whatever they felt was at a loss. East of the Rockies, Allison, we have about a minute for your question and about a minute for his answer. What did you want to bring up this evening?
Well, yeah, I don't have much time. Anyway, you kind of be retroactively pointing, you know, creating some kind of semi-homosexual cabal between Hall Caine and Tumblety and Bram Stoker, and I think that's a bit much. And surely you know, studying crime, that male homosexual serial killers kill men, male heterosexual serial killers kill women. And so that just seems, somewhat homophobic, to be honest, especially bringing such a marvelous author as Bram Stoker into all this. And then also the fact that, surely you know, I've studied Dracula for quite a bit, I must admit. Francis Tumblety was in custody on the night of November 8th, the night of the Mary Kelly murder, the last and most gruesome murder. And so it pretty much eliminates him as a large suspect, you know.
Well, the Mary Jane Kelly murder is the most likely not to have been part of the Jack the Ripper cases
as
well.
That's only been said in the recent years. No,
I'd like to deal with each of those points.
Okay.
First and foremost, I count people of single-sex relationships among some very good friends,
mm-hmm.
And have been for many years. What I have spoken of tonight is the notion of man love between Hall Caine and Bram Stoker. And that's something that Bram Stoker wrote about in his own right. It's not me putting words into his mouth. It is not any suggestions beyond the words of what Bram said and what happened. Now, to deal with homosexual killers, that's wrong. If you read Rivers' book on sexual killers, he cites a notable case in America, I believe it was in the 1950s, of a homosexual serial killer who attacked women in a very similar method to that used by the killer known as Jack the Ripper.
Yes, but what
Thank
about
you.
Dennis Nilsson, Jeffrey Dahmer?
I'm afraid that falls down. Now, the custody issue, it's thought that Tumblety was actually bailed on that night, and that's explored quite nicely in Stuart Evans and Paul Gainey's book, The Lodger, which revealed Francis Tumblety as this notable serial killer for the very first time.
Thank you for calling in, Allison. We appreciate you being a part of the show. And I want to thank you, Neil. It's been a fascinating evening. Great history, great storytelling, and we appreciate you being here with us. I also want to thank G-Back in the studio answering our phones, Nathan for all of his accomplishments and help this evening, and, of course, my own producer and engineer here back home, Tim Dennis. Of course, my producer for the evening, Chris Boros, Lisa Lyon, and the master himself, George Norrie. Thank you for joining me. I'll be back with you the 7th and 8th of May here on the best in overnight talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and you've been listening to Coast to Coast AM.